Well, that's our buddy's voice you just heard. Not the announcer, but the song, John Fogerty, who listens to Coast quite regularly, by the way. What a great guy he is. Hello, John. Okay, it's pre-Halloween, and as we get towards Halloween, we're going to be telling you and reporting on some specialized, mysterious, and ghostly story shows for you. And we've got one for you tonight. It's called America's Most Haunted. Teresa Argee, Eric Olson. Eric will be with us this hour, Teresa next hour, and then they'll both join us as we take your phone calls in our final hour on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Eric Olson. Back in 2002, Eric founded the online magazine called blogcritics.org, which he led to great heights. Then he sold it back in 2008. He then conceived and supervised the creation of an original content organization for the company that bought him, technorati.com, back in 2009 and 10. And then he founded the Morton Report in 2011. And now he has jumped into the paranormal world. He's the founder of America's Most Haunted brand, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Eric, welcome.
Thank you, George. What a pleasure. If anyone is working in the paranormal field, they have arrived when they speak with you.
But there are so many good people out there doing it. I just heard from one of them, Jimmy Church. It's just great to be in this field. And this time of year for me is the best. It's, you know, Halloween, it's October, and then we get into Thanksgiving and Christmas. I just love it. And we're kicking it off with you, so welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It is an honor in every way. I agree with you. I love Halloween. I always have. For me, nothing in terms of holidays and the family side of it, of course, can replace Christmas. But there's something about the age and the depth of Halloween that transcends all other holidays. I was just reading a story, I guess I've read many, on the founding or the creation, or I suppose evolution is really what it is, of Halloween. And it goes way, way back, thousands and thousands of years, and comes out, of course, the harvest tradition. And there was a blending of the harvest tradition with the notion that there was a certain day of the year when the veil thinned between the living and the spirit world. And the harvest tradition merged with that, especially in the Celtic tradition. And out of that, thousands of years ago, emerged many of our current Halloween traditions, the dressing up, the disguising of oneself, the carrying a lantern around, in our case, in a pumpkin. In the Irish tradition, they didn't have pumpkins, so it was a turnip. And so it's really quite amazing that these traditions that are so much at the core of what we do now, and that typically are not taken all that seriously, it's just kind of a fun holiday, and it's a time to look at the other side and not be afraid briefly. But these are old, old traditions. And sometimes in October, I remember this happened last year, I walk outside at night, and of course, this is when you work and when you are most active, so you would understand this. But you walk out there and you see that moon, especially the October full moons, and you can just feel the power.
Nothing better. Nothing better. It's just that great feeling. I was driving around L.A. with my producer, Tom, a couple days ago, and he saw a lot that people were starting to fix up, and he went, "Oh, my God, they're already getting ready to put Christmas trees in. What's going on? They're putting hay things there." And I said, "Tom, you forgot Halloween. It's a pumpkin patch. They're building that. And it's just a great time of year." You know, I know my grandchildren, my two of my six little ones back in St. Louis, they go to a place called Eckert's Farm in Illinois. And I mean, it's they just grow pumpkins, and they have a huge pumpkin patch, Eric, and people just love it. They get into this. But what is it about Halloween? What is it about people who like to be scared?
Well, I think it really is such a fundamental human emotion, and it makes us feel alive. In this day and age, as we evolve more and more away from our original human lifestyle and our association with nature, I think deep down we feel that loss. And not that it isn't there. I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot to remove the veneer of civilization. And I think, just as a side note, I think that underlies the success and the power of the post-apocalypse shows and the zombie shows. It's that we're being reminded, wow, this can all be taken away in an instant, and you are back to being on your own and surviving on your instincts and on your abilities. But I think for most of us, certainly urban people, people who have had many generations kind of away from the outdoors, people who maybe don't camp, don't spend time outside, I think this tradition, being afraid, and oh my goodness, look at the growth of the haunted attraction industry over the last 20 years, and even more so, say, the last 10 years, it has just exploded. And it's simply because it's a safe, ultimately, safe place to go and be afraid and get back in touch with your instincts. And of course, that underlies the appeal of horror movies as well. And you combine that with humor, the horror, the fright, and comedy, and I think it's pushing these two seemingly opposite buttons that I think do actually merge together, so that there's a special place in our hearts for horror comedies, or at least horror shows, movies that have a lot of humor, like Beetlejuice. I just did a tweet. I'm big on the social media. It's kind of how we've been pre-selling the brand before the book came out, and it just came out yesterday, so of course
great
we're very
timing.
Excited about that. But I did a tweet about Beetlejuice 2 finally being more or less confirmed, and all the main players are back involved, Tim Burton. And people just were, I could see them throughout the cyber world jumping up and down. I had hundreds of retweets. People were just, we love Beetlejuice. And I think it's the combination of humor and fright, and that interesting, almost in a sense, pedestrian look at the other side. And in a sense, I think we're relieved by that.
How did you jump from pretty normal things, Eric, into the paranormal?
That is an excellent question. Well, it really goes back to my childhood. I was very, very interested. I was a very big reader, and anytime I could, I'd run off to the library or bookstore and read the mysteries. And I'm talking about the existential mysteries, the world mysteries, the Shroud of Turin, and on and on and on. And then a little bit later, the Chariot of the Gods, and all those amazing, completely different world views, and it kind of pulled me out of my little pedestrian life. At the same time, I don't think so much in childhood, but certainly as I reached adolescence and all through my adolescence into my early adulthood, I had some very vivid, intense paranormal experiences. I really didn't know how to respond to them. I didn't know how to categorize them. I wasn't sure even if they were real, but certainly in retrospect, they were quite real. And I always tell the story, kind of the quintessential story of my life on the paranormal side, or at least my earlier life, was I was at college. I was a freshman at college at Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio, and I was sound asleep. It was about 3 a.m. All of a sudden, just out of nowhere, I sat up, bolt upright, wide awake, just absolutely bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. The room was dark, but on the opposite end of the room, by the door, it was even darker. And that dark presence took its time coming across the room toward me, slowly but surely. Then it engulfed me as I sat up in bed. And while I was engulfed, I had a feeling of utter helplessness. I could not move. I could not breathe that I can recall. And I was utterly paralyzed, both physically and with fright and fear. Then, although it seemed like minutes, hours, days, I'm sure it was probably just seconds.
Right,
that it
and
lasted.
A horrible feeling. Horrible
it was
feeling.
Gone. Yes, it was astonishing. And then it was gone. And when it was gone, I had a complete feeling of peace and relaxation and that everything was settled. I immediately went back to sleep. It was just boom, back to sleep as if nothing had happened. The next morning, I get a call from my mother, who was up here in the Cleveland area, and her mother, my grandmother, had died.
Oh,
and she had died at that exact moment when that experience overcame me. And not only that, my mother had the exact same experience at the exact same time. So we were very, very sure that her mother, my grandmother, who, of course, we were both very, very close to, had somehow shared that experience perhaps with us. She had died of a heart attack. And the symptoms that we had were essentially those of a heart attack. And so our hope and our cherished belief is that we shared in that experience with her and somehow hopefully relieved some of what she was going through. And then when it was over, she was gone. So you can imagine the impact that had on me. And it wasn't very long after that, maybe a year probably, that I didn't consciously, but I think I subconsciously made the decision, hey, I'm going to turn this stuff off, because I had a few other experiences. I had about kind of one major experience, though nothing as profound as that, a year when I was at college. And I think by the time I was graduating, I'm adult now, right? I'm entering the adult world.
Right.
I don't need that distraction. And to be honest, it frightened me. I mean, these were experiences that did frighten me, and I wasn't really sure how to deal with them. And they also kind of interfered with my spiritual, with my religious point of view. I was, not extremely religious, but certainly grew up in the church, in the Lutheran church, and attended quite regularly as a child. So there was kind of a disconnect there between these quote-unquote paranormal experiences and my religious beliefs. So I think for all those reasons, I turned it off. I just shut it off. And I did not have another, to my knowledge, paranormal experience for 30 years,
gosh,
maybe.
You're lucky you were able to control it.
Well, I didn't do it on purpose. You know, I this is looking back, and it may be kind of facile, and I may be,
when you say,
I think that's what happened. So getting back into it, back to your original question, returning to it has kind of felt like going home, and I kind of interrupted you. I think you're going to
ask. No, that's okay. But when you say you turned it off, the paranormal ability, does that include maybe psychic ability, maybe you had some ESP abilities? Did you turn everything off?
I think I probably did, and it wasn't completely successful, certainly. And I have always had a pretty strong intuition. In fact, I sort of developed this system within myself that the way I could tell if my relationships were real was if I felt that deep internal, and I think it is reasonable to call psychic connection. My first wife, I felt that relationship with. Eventually that relationship ended after about 10 years, but I don't think it's because, and we had two children, I don't think it was because the connection was wrong or wasn't there. It was extenuating circumstances. We were both young. We were both oldest children. We were both very immature and very spoiled. And I think those were the issues really that were at hand. Then later, when I met my current wife, Dawn, very similar, and if anything, even more intense feelings of closeness. I can intuit. I always know when she's about to call. Oh, Dawn's going to call. Phone rings. I always know.
See, that's a unique ability.
It's strange, and it's not something that I spend a lot of time thinking about on the conscious level, but it is something that has always been there. And I still do feel that very close connection, not just to voluntary relationships like wives, but to my children and to my parents, especially probably my mother. And so it's something that at this stage of my life, now that I'm middle-aged and have had plenty of life to go through and probably have less to come than I have experienced, it's time, hey, why preclude the fullness of life? Why turn things off that may, in fact, be important, that just give me a that much richer a life? So returning to the paranormal, as I say, kind of has felt like coming home. And it wasn't necessarily intentional. It was kind of mercenary, to be honest, in the latter days of Blog Critics. So I owned it and ran it, but of course I also wrote for it, and these were internet online magazines, and that's what I've been doing for, I guess, a dozen years now. So as part of it, of course, I'm writing, and I want to write the most popular possible stories and bring in traffic. So my wife and I, Dawn, about 5, 6, 7 years ago, I'd have to sit down and really figure it out, but we were in Arizona for Thanksgiving, and the kids were asleep, and we were had the TV on, we're just flipping through the dial, and we came across this show called Ghost Adventures. And what could that be? It's on Travel Channel. How odd. What are they doing? Why are ghosts on Travel Channel? And so we watched it, and we saw what they did, and they very systematically investigated. And not only were they open to the possibility that they were going to encounter ghosts, spirits, the paranormal, but they expected it. And we were just riveted by this. And then, of course, I realized there were other shows, including Ghost Hunters and many others that have come and gone in the meantime, of various, you know, reality investigation paranormal shows, and in particular the ghost shows. And so I was really, really interested. And I started covering those shows and started previewing them and reviewing them. And best of all, doing interviews with all the various people involved. And those stories, as I wrote them up, did the best. They had the highest traffic of anything. And we covered, you know, a little bit of everything: TV, film, music, pop culture in general, books, a little bit of everything. So, hey, something I'm really interested in, something that's really grabbed my attention, and something that feels kind of like a return to my youth, to my roots, also is bringing in the best traffic. So I just threw myself into it. And that's how I met Teresa. There was a show that Zach Bagans put together. It just was one season on Travel, and that was called Paranormal Challenge. And they just pitted investigative teams against each other in these super haunts, these really iconic locations, and then judged them and picked a winner. And Teresa's team was the Haunted Housewives, and we watched it, and they did really well. They ended up winning their episode, and that was down at Waverly Hills. And I was really fascinated to hear that they were from the Cleveland area, hometown, current, now hometown. Originally I'm from L.A. But so anyway, I just contacted her and did an interview, and then they invited us to come with them, my wife and I, on a ghost hunt. And we found that just astonishing.
You
were
amazing.
Hooked. We had some really, in Willoughby, had some really interesting activity. Nothing really dramatic, but kind of anything felt dramatic. We had some very sinister, pronounced laughter on EVPs. We had the lasers up, the grid, the laser grid, and several times shadows passed through that there was no possible source. So we were hooked. And one thing led to another, and I was talking to Teresa kind of more and more, and I hadn't done a book. I hadn't written a book at that point since 1999. I was an author back in the 90s, mostly music-related things, the last book being The Encyclopedia of Record Producers.
I love it. Hold on for a second, Eric. We're going to take this break, and we'll come right back.
Well, it's called Beyond Belief. It's our television program, and it strangely is beyond belief. You can watch it for 10 days. Have some fun looking at it. Sign up by going to beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Eric Olson with us. Next hour, Teresa Argy joins us, too, as we talk about America's Most Haunted. So when you got together, Eric, with Teresa, how did you two decide to write the book America's Most Haunted?
Well, believe it or not, the original impulse was the name. Because we were just here at home, and we were talking about, okay, so what's my next project going to be? We ran into some financing issues with the Morton Report, so I had to kind of turn on a dime and decide what I was going to do next. And I thought it'd be a lot of fun and very interesting to do a book, because I hadn't done one since about 99. And as you know, the whole internet era, there's lots of really great things about writing for the internet and on the internet, and the gateway is wide open and anyone can do it, and there's a lot of freedom. But it's also all very quick, very now, not a whole lot of time to reflect. And I really miss that about book writing, where you had the time to really ponder something and do the research and think about it and really work and polish your writing. So we'd had such good success with the paranormal stories on the sites that I thought that was really a good way to go, and it would be great to do a book. So we were just kind of kicking ideas around, and my older daughter said, we had the TV on in the background, and there was a promo came on for America's Most Wanted. And my daughter said, well, why not America's Most Haunted?
Excellent.
Said, no, there's no way, it can't be available. It's too obvious. There has to be, someone must own that. There have to be books. There have to be TV shows, movies. But there was not. There was nothing. No one had used that actual term. So we were just, oh, it's a godsend. We couldn't believe it. So what happened then, this was right in the midst of when I was interacting with and was very impressed by Teresa and her team. So I realized, hey, in a sense, though I certainly have had personal experiences, in terms of being a real-life veteran professional ghost hunter, I am not. So I am entering this from the media, basically, standpoint and kind of a philosophical standpoint. I'm really fascinated by the philosophical or even cosmological, I suppose, implications. If any of this is real, the implications are just staggering. But I did not have the nuts and bolts experience. And I thought, hey, that would really make a huge difference on this project. So I talked to Teresa about it. She said that'd be great. She said she had had all kinds of experiences and she really did enjoy writing. She would like some help kind of improving her writing. She hadn't really written a lot professionally. And that's how we approached it. And we were trying to decide, okay, so how many locations are we going to cover? What kind of locations? Obviously, we're calling this America's Most Haunted. So it should probably be in America, and they should probably be really haunted. Then we thought about, okay, we also are interested in the travel aspect. We want to advise people because we want these to be destinations that people can actually go to. It really doesn't much matter how haunted someone's house is, other than for them, of course, if people can't go there. So we decided to cover public or at least semi-public locations. So that gave us a foundation. We also decided we really wanted to go into depth, though not boring depth. In other words, we didn't want to write a book about each one of these locations. We wanted to take the really key elements, and those are the stories, the legends. Who are these ghosts who are believed to be at these locations? Where do they come from? Why are they there? Why are they haunted?
And you picked two locations, Eric, that I'm very familiar with. One in St. Louis, the Lemp Mansion, which we'll talk about all of them in a second, and the haunted Queen Mary out here in Long Beach.
Absolutely. And I love the Queen Mary, being from L.A. myself. And what I did for a living way back in the 80s is I owned one of the bigger club and mobile DJ company. So I'm running all over DJing parties in Southern California. And there were a lot of parties on the Queen Mary. I spent many an evening DJing in the Queen's Salon or in the other rooms. And the one story of my experience that I relate in the book, because of course, if I didn't have an experience in that location, then I'm not gonna make it up. But back in the 80s, this was kind of the one experience I did have, the one exception to the rule saying that nothing much happened between my early 20s and recent years. I was DJing, preparing to DJ, and the way it was set up then, and probably still is now, you have to go in through the back, through the loading dock, essentially, because they don't want the customers to see you pushing your equipment around and causing a disruption. So I'm in the back. I go up into the building. You have to wind your way all the narrow corridors and the very, very narrow, small elevators, and you're switching from elevator to elevator. So I finally get in what I believe is the last elevator to get me to my destination. Very tiny little thing, and I got my equipment with me. I'm rolling it in there. I'm squeezing into this elevator. All of a sudden, it feels like the walls, which were already tight, are closing in on me, and my mind just starts reeling, and I feel like breath on my neck, and I'm about to just lose it, and I'm not particularly claustrophobic. I've really never had a claustrophobic experience, but I'm sure that is what an intense claustrophobic episode feels like. All of a sudden, right behind literally in my ear, a voice says, "Tight quarters." I about lost my mind, and I can't go anywhere. I'm in an elevator, you know, and I'm tiny little space. It was surreal. When those doors opened, I bat out of hell, out of that elevator. And believe me, my performance that evening was rather skewed. So that is my main personal Queen Mary experience, but it is a very, very vivid one. Amazing. Go ahead.
Well, how did you all pick the 10 locations specifically?
We came up with about 100 that seemed to fit the requirements. We knew we wanted to cover at least a significant portion of the really well-known, iconic super haunts. But we also knew we wanted to have a little bit of variation. We wanted to have a little bit of regional aspect to it. Hey, we are both here in Ohio. We have had more experiences with locations in this general area. And we ended up picking kind of the least well-known one, the place that we had our publication party at last night. It's just it's literally a hardware store in Willoughby, Ohio, called Willoughby Cole and Garden Center. But that is where Teresa's team, the Haunted Housewives, are based. That is their home quarters, and they have had experience after experience there. That is a fascinating place, and I'm sure she will do an outstanding job telling you about Willoughby Cole. But what happened to me, and this shows how much things have changed for me in recent times, is when we were kind of scouting out Willoughby Cole a few days before the party, because of course we wanted to transform it into a place that people could come and have
sure.
fun, and we were going to set up tables and decorate and all that. So we're up on the third floor, which is basically open. It's not part of the store itself. So it's just mostly open space, some storage. And we were up there, and we're figuring out where we're going to put the tables and the chairs and how we're going to arrange and where we're going to stand when we're talking. And I'm looking over in one corner of the building, and for some reason my attention was just drawn to that corner, and I kept looking at the corner, and Teresa was talking, and I was kind of talking, though I have no memory of what I said. And all of a sudden, my whole field of vision, but just in that one corner, starts pixelating, just like if your TV, when your cable is a digital TV, when the cable starts going and that screen starts breaking up into pixels. That's exactly what was happening in my field of vision.
Huh.
And then Kathy, who is Teresa's partner in the Haunted Housewives and who is a medium, who is a psychic, she looks over, she said, are you seeing something? And then she followed my line of vision, looked over and said, yep, there he is. So I had a very vivid experience in Willoughby Cole just a couple days ago.
Now, you were going to say something about the Lemp Mansion in St. Louis.
I think the Lemp is possibly all these locations, the 10 locations, all have such amazing kind of foundation, historical tales behind them. But the tale, the story of the Lemp family is just so amazing. And it's intertwined with the history of American business, with the history of the brewing industry.
Sure.
And who isn't interested in the brewing industry?
They were huge beer makers at the time, competing with Anheuser-Busch in St. Louis. But something went awry with the family. It might have been a curse. Who knows? But there were several suicides there.
There were. It's very, very strange. It really does lend credence to the theory that suicide is contagious. And I think it makes sense because when it happens, as awful as it is, it plants the notion in those around that person, and certainly no one is closer than the family, that it's an option. And even if you intellectually reject it outright, you know, on some deep emotional level, it may find some resonance. And if you are troubled, and of course, again, emotional troubles, mental illness, instability, I mean, that tends to run in families.
Sure.
Obviously, there's a hereditary aspect to it. I'm sure there's also, of course, an environmental aspect, but it would only make sense that that kind of thing would run in families. So once the contagion began, and the original impetus was simply the collapse of the business, basically with prohibition is what happened. Brewers everywhere, alcohol manufacturers throughout the country were essentially wiped out. Some were smart. Some were able to find alternative products, whether they be what we would call soft drinks now or even non-alcoholic beer, and were well enough financed to stick it out and make it through that 10-year period. But others were not. And the Lemps, just the business collapsed. And the son, Billy, just couldn't take it. And that was it. So he began the process. But it's a fascinating building. It's a beautiful place, and it's being run now essentially as a restaurant and a bed and breakfast / hotel, I suppose, in. And it's an amazing place. It's a beautiful place. It's a really fascinating, interesting place. And just the whole history of how the industry came to be, because remember, this began way back in the mid-1800s.
Oh, absolutely.
Before refrigeration.
Yeah. What a huge mansion it is, if you assume what it was like in its pristine condition.
And the caves. There's caves underneath.
That's where they stored a lot of the beer.
Exactly, because it kept at a cool, steady temperature. So that was a real breakthrough. And then they were very much on the forefront, though, of the technological breakthrough. So as soon as artificial refrigeration was invented, they definitely picked up on it. And gradually they moved away from the storage, the cold storage or cool storage in the caves underneath and went to artificial. And gradually the family actually kind of took over the caves and built a pool down there and various rooms and a theater. I mean, this was an absolute lap of luxury. This was one of the prominent families in the country. When I was doing research on the background, I found essentially the history of the family in articles in the New York Times.
Oh, yeah. They
Not
were written
the
about.
St. Louis paper.
No.
But the New York
the
Times.
Place. Yeah, they were national, maybe international. But wasn't there a curse on the family?
Well, that is, of course, one of the theories. It's not like a gypsy curse. It's not something that was wrought upon them. But the family itself certainly did seem to be cursed. That is for sure. And boy, they really seem to be hanging around the place. And again, that's another great story. That was one of the few places that once we started work on the book, Teresa and I did go and investigate these places, many of these places, together. And then, of course, that was woven in with stories of her experiences dating back several years, in some cases, many years. But that was one of the places where she was able to go on her own, because I couldn't make it, travel to St. Louis with Kathy, her haunted housewife investigation partner. And they stayed there overnight. And they had some really vivid and intense experiences throughout the whole building. So that's another great set of stories to talk to Teresa about in the next hour. I think you'll be amazed by her range of knowledge and experience. Again, I feel very strongly that this was, you know, kind of a ideal complementary relationship, in that I was able to bring probably a larger cultural view. It's probably the vertical and the horizontal.
It's a good mix.
She is an expert on ghosts. I have a broader sort of interest, and I'm also interested in the scientific ramifications of this, and all the recent discoveries in particle physics and the various theories about alternative universes. Those all very much apply, or could apply, to the paranormal.
Are you a believer in the ghostly realm now?
I'm absolutely a believer that there is something going on that transcends the standard scientific worldview in the Western world as we now see it. It may not be, quote unquote, the spiritual realm. It may just be forms of energy that have yet to be discovered. You know, there's nothing, the cliche that magic is just science before we figure it out, there's a lot of truth to that. And things that look like magic looked like magic 100 years ago, 500 years ago, certainly a couple thousand years ago. Now we have perfectly rational, reasonable, scientific, materialistic, I suppose, even mechanistic descriptions of. And there's no reason to think that our knowledge will not continue to grow, our scientific knowledge. But I do believe that there is always going to be another reality that intersects with the physical reality. I am a dualist. I do think that the mind or the spirit or the soul, whatever term you want to put on it, does have its own separate reality apart from the body. So for me, it's some combination of all of that.
I love that. Well, stick with us. We're going to come back in a moment. And Eric, what are your next adventures? What do you do next?
Well, we definitely hope to have enough success with this book. And goodness, the initial reactions are so positive, so strong. We are extremely, extremely gratified at the response. It doesn't matter what we think. Of course we think it's good. You know, we worked on it for 2 years, and we tried really, really hard, and we thought it was fascinating material, great stories, and we worked hard on the writing. But to have people, real people, the real world, respond that way, and again, of course, it's so early. I mean, it just came out yesterday, but we hope to be able to continue on and have this be a series. You know, we're saying America's most haunted. Well, that doesn't preclude there being other locations. As I said earlier, our initial list was of about 100 places, and pretty much any one of those, honestly, you know, could have made it into the book. We really did try to pick the ones we thought were the 10 most haunted. But there's another 10 and another 10 after that that all have great stories that fit all our requirements. They're public, they're semi-public, they have great stories, they have lots and lots of evidence. So we would like to continue on with that. I also have another project.
All right, well, you're going to have to hold on. You're going to come back in the last hour Teresa joins us next.